Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on our YouTube channel. I'm Joseph Fink, the President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, and I'm also the former Chairman of the Board of the Commonwealth Club. And more importantly for this evening, I'm your moderator. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Two-term mayor of San Francisco, the legendary speaker of the California State Assembly, and widely regarded as one of the most influential African-American politicians in the history of this country. Willie L. Brown has been at the center of California politics, government, and civic life for an astonishing five decades. His career spans the American presidency from Lyndon Johnson to Barack Obama. And he's worked with every California governor from Pat Brown to our present governor, Pat's son, Jerry Brown. From civil rights to education reform, tax policy, economic development, healthcare, international trade, domestic partnerships, and affirmative action, he's left his mark on every aspect of politics and public policy in the Golden State. As the mayor of California's most cosmopolitan city, actually, let me take that back. As the mayor of the nation's most cosmopolitan city, he refurbished and rebuilt the nation's busiest transit system, pioneered the use of bond measures to build affordable housing, created a model juvenile justice system, paved the way for the second campus of the University of California at San Francisco, did a great deal in regard to biotechnology and the internet. Today he heads the Willie L. Brown Jr. Institute on Politics and Public Service, where this acknowledged master of art of politics shares his knowledge and skills with a new generation of California leaders. He also writes a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, and earlier this year, the western span of the Bay Bridge was officially named in his honor. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome the Honorable Willie Brown.
The movement of the Commonwealth Club from that wonderful facility over on Market Street, within a walking distance of my home, to this place where ordinarily they would have the symbol of the privacy of the conversations. They'd have a black cat, not me. They'd have a black cat. And everything said, theoretically, in this press facility was off the record. I don't understand how the Commonwealth Club can show up someplace where nothing is taken seriously and house their operation here. But I'm told it's for 1.5 years before they move back to God's country, down on the Embarcadero, where they will have a brand new home. And it'll be a home that I think will probably be more comfortable than these rented chairs that you're seated in, I hope. And I'm just looking forward to it, because the Commonwealth Club is an important institution. Since, I don't know, almost 10 years now, I think, since I left elective office, they have asked me to come every May and talk about the city and discuss the politics of the city and anything else I want to talk about. And I usually do the latter, not the former. I do the latter, and I'm going to do that tonight. In the past, I've spent probably at least half of the time in formal lecture mode, but tonight is going to be different. I watched a little bit from afar the Commonwealth Club's presentation with Andy Young and a couple of other people, and the dialogue in the seated chair by the fireside interested me more, because the questions that came eliminated the need to prepare a speech. And that's an advantage, as you would readily recognize. But I would be, I wouldn't be doing my duty unless I did do some formal remarks. And my formal remarks begins with the terrible experience that I had yesterday. I had to be in Southern California. I was invited to... that's not the terrible experience. But see, it's a change. People laugh more in this place than they did in the other place. But I was in Southern California for a meeting of an organization that I serve on the advisory board for, and they had chosen a site in Ventura County. Now, I probably would not have attended if I had known it was Ventura County, because there's no human way to get to Ventura County easily without a real challenge. I flew into Santa Barbara, and then I took a car, and it took an hour and a half to get from Santa Barbara Airport to this incredible spa inn. It's called the Ojai Valley Inn. It's an incredible place if you can get there. But it's clearly hidden so that ordinary people could not get there. They don't even have an airport or a helipad, so that everybody's got to put in a lot of time in order to get there. And of course, I was already annoyed by the time I left, because when I got on the plane, it was one of those little bitty planes that you fly in places where there's no directed controlled air traffic. And that was the nature of that flight. And I really became somewhat disturbed when the pilot said, after we got loaded, he said, we have a disproportionate distribution of weight on this plane, and we need to move some people around. We need to. I started thinking, wait a minute. Now, I know. I watched the people come on the plane. I got on the plane early. I watched the people come on the plane, and I know at least half of those people lied about their weight if they had been asked about their weight. So I can understand his desire. But several people got up and volunteered, including the person that was sitting right next to me. And he was eager to volunteer, which made me kind of nervous. Maybe he knows something. I'm not going to sit here in seat number 2 in the front if he's going to the back. But we managed to get, and then we landed in San Francisco, and we landed like 5 minutes early. So I was really overjoyed with the fact that I'd gotten back to San Francisco in the shortest period of time, and then I got in the car. Major mistake, because as soon as I got on the roadway on Ronald Run, it took from the time I landed to another 50 minutes to get to downtown San Francisco. Now, I live South Market in an alley in an assisted living facility, so you can get there very easily, ordinarily. But this was one of those days, I guess, when it was the most complicated movement of traffic that I have witnessed. And I then begin to reflect upon how many of you have said something to me, either by way of an email or on person, about your problem of trying to maneuver through San Francisco. And I decided to spend a little bit of time today reassessing by going to the spots and taking a look. And I came away with the fact that we really do have a serious traffic problem in San Francisco, and we need to deal with that serious traffic problem in San Francisco. And so tonight, I want to talk just a little bit about some ideas that are rolling around in my head. You know, Google has made this watch, which I've ordered. It hasn't gotten here yet. But I'm going to have a good time walking down the street saying, "Hello, Eleanor. How are you?" Talking to my staff or whomever, right to your watch. But Google made that watch, and they did a considerable amount of research in dealing with that watch. And there have been other tech organizations that have done fabulous kinds of things for certain purposes. It seems to me we're at the stage on the side of the business of how do you take a place like San Francisco and other places throughout America that are now, I suppose, arriving almost at the point where they should be. People want to live together. We don't want to live in isolated places anymore. We want to live densely populated. We want to live where we can see each other. We want to live where we can interact with each other. We want to live where we can connect with each other. All these newcomers, so-called, to San Francisco are people who really want to live here, and they're going to keep coming. And as a result of that, and they go on places similar, in places like Austin, Texas, in places in Raleigh, North Carolina, in places like New York. People are really moving in a dense fashion. Populations want to live in a dense world. And believe me, if Google can come up with an idea as clever as that watch is and all of the things that that watch could do, I think it's about time for Google and their crowd to come up with some ideas about how to help in this horror of all of us trying to move around. Now, I got some ideas. I got some real good ideas, I think. I was an advocate of automobiles. When I was licensed to drive many years ago, I actually had 11 cars at one time. Now, you can imagine what a sicko I must have been to have that many cars, but I had 11 cars, and there are people who are similarly situated, and in some cases, I had no business driving any one of those cars. Well, I suspect that we ought to start thinking more positively about all the potential for these cars that are without drivers. I am excited about the possibility of the cars without drivers, because suddenly, if car without drivers, and if I don't buy it, can't buy it, if all I can do is lease it or call it up like I do Flywheel and Uber and Lyft and those cars, I call it when I need it. And it shows up out at the front door. I get in it, and it takes me wherever. All I have to do is say, you know, home, James, or wherever I want to go, and then suddenly that car heads in that direction. That car guides itself with all the sensors and all the other things that technology has now produced, and suddenly that car gets me to where I'm going. That car stops, the door opens, I get out, and the car takes off to pick somebody else up some other place if it's been so ordered. Just think of how incredible that would be. You could get back to drive, to moving it by yourself without anybody else around. You could get back to the business of no parking on any streets. Just think, you could get to the street that we're having trouble getting through on Montgomery. It's just terrible trying to get down Montgomery every day, and they got people parking on Montgomery. Well, the concept of driverless vehicles, that would all be eliminated, because those vehicles wouldn't be there unless they were dropping somebody off. And when they dropped somebody off, they would take off and go some other place. And just think of how incredible that concept could be. Now, I come up with the idea, and somebody else has got to figure out how to really implement it. But people are making driverless vehicles. And I know that there are some challenges. There's a whole question about what do you do on the insurance side? What do you do in an emergency? You can work all that out. You have worked it out currently on the computers for almost everything else. Why can't you work it out? So suddenly, the whole question of movement of people becomes dramatically different. As I walked around today, I don't understand where we got the idea that we could use those articulated buses on anything except long, straight streets. I don't know where we got the idea in this antiquated width of streets in our city that you can have articulated big buses moving around. And it seems to me one of the other ideas I have is I watched all those double-deckers. Well, the double-deckers take a lot of people, and they pick them, take a lot of people. If we could somehow figure out how to make riding the double-decker bus free and put more double-decker buses on, my guess is we would reduce the number of other cars. The idea is obviously to get cars off the streets unless they're operating in a fashion where they don't stay on the streets as things unfold and as you need them. So I've got all these crazy ideas, but I'm telling you, I got a ton of them all surrounding the business of how do you manage traffic. Now just think of how dangerous I would really be were I mayor, because I'd be trying to implement these ideas. And so I'm going to see if I can't get my friend Ed Lee to consider the possibility. He's running for re-election. He needs some new brilliant ideas. He needs to be responsive to your demands. And in addition thereto, you know, we got some other issues. Like, for an example, when I came up 3rd Street, I had one bad street after another at the roadway. It was bumpy, bumpy, bumpy. I said to the guy who was driving me, "What's wrong with your car?" He says, "Not my car, it's your streets, Mr. Mayor. They've got holes in them all over, and you really ought to do something about it." Well, I begin to think, I know why we're not doing a whole lot about the streets these days, because we're not doing a whole lot about the streets anywhere in this country. And in this state, we're not doing a whole lot about these streets. How is it that we can't seem to have enough money to address that kind of infrastructure? Well, you got to know that in the quest to go and have automobiles that perform much better, get longer miles with fewer gallons of gasoline and with more clean and pure gasoline, suddenly we've got all these alternative fuel vehicles that are not paying the same gas tax. We've not raised the gas tax in a long time. Vehicles that were going only 10 miles per gallon are now going 40 miles per gallon, and they're using the same amount of the roadway, so we aren't getting the same amount of money we used to get. So we obviously need quickly to figure out how do we come up with a system that will produce your use of the roads as to what is paid by you and the car that you're in. And my guess is if you start doing that, you'd begin to have people ceasing to use as much, because you don't really use as much if it costs you more for use. You tend to be very economical about the use. Well, we need to figure out how to do that, because we need to generate revenue in order to do something about smoothing out 3rd Street. I don't care about the rest of your streets, but I move up and down 3rd Street, and I'm sure you have the same attitude about your street. But we do need to find a way to do what we formerly did back in, I don't know, 93, when we first bumped the gas tax nationwide to 18.5 cents. We haven't touched it since. Yet we have had a further and a greater distance by almost every car with fewer amounts of gasoline and therefore fewer gas tax coming forward for the purpose of being of assistance to the roads that they need to be of assistance to. And obviously, simultaneously, a whole series of other things surrounding that use, because believe me, from the standpoint of just how do you make sure that the environment and the air is cleaner, you keep pushing people toward alternative fuel vehicles, but you've got a problem because the roadway is being used just as aggressively and for just as much time as it was when it was just the opposite. So you've got to try to address those issues. And I would, of course, tell the elected types we ought to do something all collectively about that. And in San Francisco, the elected types, their whole series of running, you probably don't know it because the city is interested in electorally speaking. We have figured out how to assist you if you want to run by giving you money. We have figured out how to place a cap on where you can get money as you go about running. We have made it so that you have to report everything under the sun associated with your candidacy, and we have clearly made it less attractive and less exciting to run for public office. And in that process, we have reduced the number of contests being offered in any category. You know, I ran 18, 19 times. I lost one time, and I got elected all the other times, but I've never been fortunate enough to not have an opponent. There was always somebody that challenged me, and I don't understand why, but they always did challenge me, Now, but that's not the case in San Francisco, apparently, anymore. We have several people running for election in San Francisco, and only two of them have opponents. We've got a mayor running. At the moment, no opponent. And by the way, they've changed the rules. If you don't say you want to run by the 9th of June, you are barred from running unless you do it by way of a write-in. Now, formerly one time we waited till August to have people make a decision about whether or not they'd be interested in running. Well, the politicians have figured out how to reduce the potential for anybody running by moving the date really forward. And they've moved the date up so that, in fact, if you don't say something by the 9th of June, you aren't going to be able to run for office, either for supervisor or for mayor. Now, there are four or five other offices that you can run for, but they're still eligible until August for persons. People like the treasurer's office is open, or the district attorney's office is open this time around. The city attorney's office is open this time around. So we got a whole series. Only one person, however, who's in the challenge situation, and that is the situation involving the sheriff. We have a sheriff who has to run for re-election, and you can run for sheriff if you want to till August. You have to file by August if you really want to run. Currently, the sheriff has an opponent, or a former deputy sheriff who was the interim sheriff when he was on the beach for a few months, he has an opponent. Currently, he only has one serious opponent. He could ultimately have more. As a matter of fact, almost all of them could have an opponent. George Hasson, the DA, doesn't have an opponent. Cisneros doesn't have an opponent. I mean, it's amazing how people don't want to run. And these jobs pay good money. And they are fun jobs, or they are challenging jobs. They're status jobs, but people don't seem to want to run. And I suspect it's because of all the things that I described that makes it uninteresting and unattractive to run for public office. However, there is one contest that's being highlighted by everybody in San Francisco this time around, particularly those in the political know, and that's over in the third district, or supervisorial district. Ed Lee appointed a woman named Julie Christensen to the job that was created by David Chu's going off to Sacramento, and Aaron Peskin, who formerly was a supervisor till 2004, has decided he can come back. I would have to say that you got to evaluate that almost like Tiger trying to win another Masters. Going to be difficult, but there is obviously that possibility. But that is a serious contest, and it has some interesting sidelines to it. It has interesting sidelines to it because friends and relatives are dividing up differently than what they were yesterday, and suddenly enemies are being embraced by friends and relatives for whatever reasons that they can offer for that embracement. And so suddenly you've got a real contest. And then, of course, Mr. Peskin is being very smart. He is not showing up anywhere, period. Sometimes you do better if people don't know and don't remember and are not reminded by your presence. They may have think you passed on or something, and this is somebody new with a name like that. And so he's being very careful not to present himself so that he can be questioned. Or the one thing you don't want to do is be questioned nationally, for an example. I'm here tonight. My friend Hillary Clinton is in town at two or three other events. And when I said that, no, I can't make it, I've got to go speak to some people. Can I come? No, you cannot come, Hillary. These are people who, it's a different deal. But she is being very careful. She wants to get the nomination for the presidency, and on the Democratic side of the aisle, it appears it's hers to lose, as some people are saying. Well, she wants to make sure she doesn't lose it by giving interviews. So she's given no interviews to any press person for whatever reason she wishes not to be questioned. And my guess is because I think she's been a candidate in the past, and granting interviews proved to be disabling for her on the vote side, and so she's not going to do that anymore. And candidates can do that. That's their choice, so, period. Some of us really love to hear ourselves talk, so we give interviews no matter what. Others don't want to be interviewed because you may ask them some question that might embarrass them, or they don't want you to ask them that question, period, because, you know, you will then write about how I saw a frown on their face when I asked that question. They hesitated, and it was clear that their breath was taken away by the width and breadth of my question. Well, you know, people don't want that kind if they're running for office, and so I think she's in that category. But on the other hand, she's got now about nine Republicans, and none of them all comes close to being a real competitor for Hillary, except one. Bush out of Florida is probably the one that is potentially the most competitive, and I think Hillary is hoping for Bush. She would love nothing better than to have Bush and make you believe that it's the other Bush that ran, so that he will have to explain 8 years of his conduct of doing all those wars and all those bad things that happened during his time in office. And so she's really hoping that the American people, as sometimes isolated from facts, as Americans are sometimes so isolated, she's hoping to be able to get that benefit. However, there's a whole series of other characters she wouldn't mind running against. Paul, for an example, she'd love to see him because he reinvents himself at each presentation, so you never know what you're going to get. And of course, she would love Huckabee because he still thinks he's a Southern Baptist preacher, and he conducts himself that way. And Scott Walker is equally as untalented at presenting himself. And the only one she's got to kind of worry about is Christie, but then she doesn't have to worry much about him, the governor of New Jersey, because he can't get through a Republican primary. He's better off going to a Democratic convention and trying to get the nomination than he would be a Republican convention trying to get the nomination. And then they got a black guy running. The Republicans are amazing. They are more, you know, with it, seemingly, than the Democrats. They always seem to have some black guy. Last time it was the guy that sold pizzas. Herman Cain, Godfather's Pizza, and he was their nominee. This time they got a guy named Ben Carson, talented apparently, gifted neurosurgeon, great hands, etc. They've done television programs about him, etc. Except that when you hear him, you cannot understand where he got the hands. Because they clearly are not connected to the head. But the Republicans are fascinated. They're fascinated with him, and they really are carried away with the idea that this cat is running, and he has announced that he, too, is running. And then you've got a series of U.S. senators running. You've got Ted Cruz, on, and there's only one person can really talk to Ted Cruz, and that's Ben Carson, the guy that I just spoke about. And then you got Rubio from Florida, who was a protege of Bush when Bush was governor of Florida, and he clearly, in my opinion, is going to defer to Bush at some times in the not too distant future. And you can see that I'm just looking forward to the next collection of people that actually get in the race. And there are a couple of others who talk about getting in the race. On the Democratic side, a senator, an independent senator from I think it's Connecticut or New Hampshire or someplace, or Vermont, who is Bernie Sanders is talking about running, and he's going to be an interesting character in the race, but he won't go any place. Joe Biden is looking at the possibility, and Jerry Brown wakes up every morning and reads the paper to make sure that there's no opportunity that he's missing in the process. And so there, you know, the whole series of Democrats who are interested, maybe, if it appears as if Hillary is not the horse. But I'm predicting that Hillary will be the nominee, and I'm hopeful because I am supporting Hillary, and I could use a win for a change in, you know, in the whole operation. Well, that's kind of where things are at the moment politically. I've spoken much longer than I had anticipated formally because I want to get to the more interesting part of these appearances by me. It's always at what point do you and your question get asked, and that's the point at which you say, what a great evening. So I'm about to give you the opportunity to have that. And so, Dr. Joe, let's start the questions with the people who want to answer.
Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, a noted political commentator, for his comments this evening. Willie, you notice that we've been doing this about 12 or 13 years now, and the first time we get into a place was a former bar. They give us three glasses of water up here.
Yours is water?
I can't wait for the for the St. Regis Hotel manager to find out that you've called his hotel an assisted living head. All right, we have a whole host of questions that cover both local, state, and national politics. And since you concluded on national politics, let's go back there for a few minutes. You've looked at the pros and cons, sort of each of the Republican candidates. But if you had to make a prediction about which one is actually going to get the nomination, considering the state of the Republican Party today, who do you really believe is going to be the opponent come the election day in 2016?
The Republicans had spectacular success in 2014. And they had that success because they became practical at each one of the turns as to which candidate they would support and allow to run. They have great control. They will make that decision the same way in this presidential debate. And I think this time it will not be a Romney, it will be Bush. And I think they will do so because that's the guy most likely to be able to compete with Hillary. He may be the only guy that can get any crossover votes, period. And so I think it will be Bush out of Florida as the nominee.
Okay, thank you. You know, one person you didn't mention was Carly Fiorina. Deborah Sanders had a column a couple of months ago pointing out the fact that when Ms. Fiorina left after the unsuccessful Senate race, she also left $500,000 in bills around San Francisco and never paid them when she left. Do you think that'll ever become an issue along the way?
Of course. Your debts are always, you have to face your debts. And people remind you, if you haven't paid them, they ask the money in the most embarrassing way. I didn't mention her because I don't really think that candidacy is operational yet. She says she's going to run, but so far there's been nothing other than her uttering those words. And she has already had a major loss tagged to her. She ran for Senate and was beaten soundly. And I think that Republicans won't be even concerned about her candidacy as because of her track record, period.
Yeah. You know, we've had Hillary is the obvious candidate for the Republican Party, and Bernie Sanders is talking about running. And
you mean Democratic Party?
Democratic Party. And Bernie Sanders is
that may have been true.
Obvious,
you said she was the obvious candidate for the Republican Party.
Oh, did I?
Yes, you did.
I'm sorry.
You sure that's water?
I'll let you know in a little while. So we have a couple of people possibly running, but it doesn't seem as if there's a real
Democratic bench there. It doesn't seem as if there are a series of people that are really out there who could possibly be president or the nominee if something happened to Hillary somewhere along the
way. No, I disagree with you. I think that there are, Dr. Fink. I think, frankly, that the performance put on last time he was here by Biden changed my mind about his possibility. I think Jerry Brown is hands down the best at being able to attract people of color to his candidacy. That's a Democratic stronghold. He can clearly mix it up with the techies, and that's going to be an important collection of people. In spite of his age, the young folks still relate to Jerry Brown. He speaks their language, and he does all the things that these young people want to do for communication purposes. He's aware that technology has outstripped the regulatory authority. That's why he kind of skips even talking to the regulators and just kind of make the pronouncements of what's going to happen, including the legislature, and that's an attractive thing for people. I think he's also a Democrat who can attract more independents than even Hillary Clinton, and I think independents are going to play a greater role in this presidential election than they have ever played in any of our memories. So he represents, in my opinion, the best alternative candidate if Hillary is not the candidate. However, I'm hopeful that Hillary is the candidate, and I'm hoping that Hillary will choose, believe it or not, a woman to run with her. And if she does, it will change the whole nature of the election. It will no longer be just a referendum on Hillary. It'll be woman versus man. And I think in America, man loses.
There have been a number of criticisms that popped up, not just by the Republican Party, but also by the media in various ways, including the New York Times, particularly regarding the donations made to the Clinton Foundations. How badly do you think Hillary is going to be hurt by that kind of a situation?
Well, at the moment, she's reeling because there has not been the kind of information sharing that should have been done before she announced. A couple of days ago, President Clinton was on the Today Show on morning, and I think he did an incredible job of being in one of the African nations where he was actually participating in the services being rendered to the kids paid for by the foundation. And then there was a graduation exercise, and the stadium was filled, and this was the first time there had been ever a graduation in that particular village. He did like five or six things, and it was incredible that he must have had maybe 15 minutes of that show, something in the neighborhood of 15 minutes, where he really did demonstrate what is going on with the foundation. And he made the foundation far more interesting than the Red Cross or than any of the other organizations that we all just respect because we think they're doing the right thing. He even showed one of the photographs of his appearance in Haiti with First Bush, where they were doing the thing after the quake in Haiti. You know, what he didn't do, and fortunately for him, he didn't do it. The two of them could have been down there right now, and Haiti would look the same as it looked 7 years ago when the quake first hit, or whatever the number of years, and when we all sent some money, we all did all those things. None of that money apparently has ever really gotten there to do anything about the problem. But it was a good shot because that made us all aware that this was not just some guy collecting money and buying a jet for himself and a vacation home and Wilkes Bashford suit. None of that. It was a guy who really was doing good things for people who needed them. And that kind of presentation will blunt the hostility that the Republicans will try to generate by suggesting, in some cases actually saying, that the foundation has received money as a disguise to make the Clintons wealthy. That question was put to Clinton in that fashion, and he says, oh, yes. But keep in mind, when we left the White House, we owed $14 million just in legal fees. And that U-Haul that moved us, we took many things that we've gotten as gift. We had nothing. And since then, we have been writing books, speech making all over the globe, and being paid well for it. She said, well, word is that you had X number of speeches at $500,000 a speech. He says, absolutely, and I wish I could get a lot more because I give 25% of what I earn through my speech making to the foundation. He went through all of those kinds of things, and it was a great performance, but it is what they should have done, and they should have literally, they should have bought an hour of television time, and they should have had a documentary on what the foundation has done, and they should have interviewed some of the donors from the foundation, maybe not the ones from the Middle East, but from some other place, so that you could really get a different view of who was given the money to the foundation, and you'd have a view of what is going. And then he should have had some third-party verifiers, i.e., some of the recipients. You know, sometimes when President speaks at the State of the Union, they always have three or four examples of what they are about, and they identify with people that we all have even forgiven or forgotten any negatives about them, and we have something positive. I think Bill Clinton would have, if he had shown up, every other sentence would have been one of where there would be another verifier. Yes, I am a beneficiary of the foundation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then when anybody said anything about the foundation, it wouldn't have the same flavor that it currently has. It has the flavor of your not knowing about it, our not knowing about it. And we have a tendency as a collection of human beings to want to believe the worst until somebody dispels it. And with facts, and Clinton should have done that.
Okay, thank you. There are a number of questions regarding issues as well as personalities, but there are a couple of questions I feel like I should ask that have come from the audience because more than one person has asked. One of them had to do with Elizabeth Warren. What's your take on Elizabeth Warren?
I think she's has a great future, but I don't think it's now.
And the other person whose name has come up is Andrew Cuomo, who's the governor of New York, the governor with the largest state, who's done has a good record there and has, looks like a shoo-in for re-election. What, why is he not being mentioned as more often as a presidential candidate?
He's New York already. She's New York. He really is. It's unfortunate for him, but he is in a location and a place where there just isn't any space on the stage for anybody else at the moment. You've got Schumer, who is going to take over for Reid as the head of the Senate. And Schumer, you'd be well advised not to get in his way if there's a camera. He is just really enthusiastic about expressing himself. And so the governor of New York, unfortunately, is located. It's geographically in the wrong space at this time in the world of politics.
All right, thank you. In one of your recent columns, I think it was this past Sunday, you were talking about the situations concerning so many killings of young and not so young black men by police officers. And you talked about the fact that it wasn't a racial problem, it was more of a cop problem. Would you elaborate on that, please?
Well, what I said, and if you didn't read the column.
Everyone here read it, but they wanted more thoughts.
Let me ask it. Lie to me. Raise your hand. Did you read my column? let me say that I've been watching for the last year, year and a half, all of these incidents involving the police and black youngsters, males in particular, since the Trayvon Martin incident that wasn't a police, but it was disguised as a police and it was dealt with as if it was a police issue by the police in many cases. And then there were just a whole series of these incidents, and every time they had the same flavor. It was a white cop and a black young male. And then you get the Oscar Grant situation where you got the local application of it, and you could never get past or having to discuss it from a race standpoint. You could never get, literally, you could never get with any of us. And I always thought that's, we've got to somehow discuss this as a time when we ought to reexamine what authority and what assumptions will we as a society tolerate in the law enforcement world, in the public safety world, regardless of race. But you can never get that conversation going. You can't get it, you couldn't get it going in the law schools, you couldn't get it going or in the ACLU world, you couldn't get it going anywhere. Nobody was addressing that issue. And along comes the incident in Baltimore. And all of a sudden, you had to look at it quite differently. And when you see that there were six cops involved, and three of them were black, when you see that police spokesperson and the head of the commissioner is black, a former guy out of Oakland, and then you look up and you see that the woman who is the mayor of the town, black, then you see all. Then you see the woman who is going to do potentially the prosecuting at the state level is black. Suddenly, you got a whole black deal going. So now you can't say, "Well, you know, this is a white cop on a black guy." You had to now say, "What would have caused these cops to treat this person that way?" And it obviously wasn't race. The cop mentality in this nation. And cops, I had a great working relationship with my police department when I served as mayor, and I still have a great relationship with many of those persons who are there. But I can tell you that what they have been, how they have been trained, and the culture that they are a part of, and how we have treated in this nation is not dissimilar from what it was for me in my little hometown of Mineola, Texas. I said in my column that there was a high sheriff, that's who ran everything. And interestingly enough, his name was Big Boy. But he was a high sheriff, and he didn't even have to go out and look for you. They'd say, "Hey man, the sheriff said he needs to see you. You go see the sheriff, because if the sheriff came to see you, you had no idea what may happen to you if he had to come out." And that was just common, whether you were black or white. It was the same way. This Big Boy was the policeman. He was the DA. If there was, I don't remember anybody being prosecuted. I remember being persecuted, but not prosecuted. He was the guy who sentenced you. He was the guy who determined whether or not you'd obeyed the sentence. I mean, it was incredible the amount of power he really had. He determined what your fine was and how much and how many days you had to spend in jail. He did all those things. And that mentality goes all the way back, I suspect, to the days when there was a movie, Westerns. You remember one time we were all carried away with Westerns in this country. And in every Western, it was always the sheriff or the marshal who was everything. The mayor was subservient in those towns to the marshal and to the sheriff. The sheriff was everything. The sheriff had the gun. The sheriff could make everybody else take their guns off, and there was no question that you couldn't appeal it. You if you did, you had to appeal it to him, and he took you to jail. He didn't read you your rights. Our law enforcement has grown out of that kind of frontier, pioneer mentality, and it's carried over to the present day. We've long since needed to engage in honest dialogue with the police authorities in this nation, with the law enforcement people in this nation, to move them away from that old mentality into the new day, where people actually, under our democratic process, want to talk back. You talk to your children, and they want to talk back. I didn't talk back to my grandmother. That was a capital offense to talk back to my grandmother. But my kids felt no question. They called me Willie Brown. They didn't call me Dad. And they would literally argue with me. Well, the kids stood there even more, because what they do is they look it up on the Internet, and they have a better answer than their parents can provide, and they assert their answer. And they don't want to be told and given directions without some consultation. The public is the same way. Yet our police world is still of the opinion that you are just supposed to obey. You're just supposed to submit. You're not supposed to assert that you have any rights whatsoever. We are all of the opinion we do have rights, and we ought to be able to assert them. And that always generates a real danger operation. In addition thereto, race is obviously still an issue in all aspects of law enforcement. The numbers are just so disproportionately, dramatically different for white people versus black people in every situation involving law enforcement. That's just a reality. Somebody said, well, you're playing a race card, Willie Brown. I am not. That is just a reality. You in San Francisco, Jeff Adachi was telling me the other day that we're only 6% of the population. We're more than 50% of the people who are arrested. And so I said, Adachi, did it occur to you? We may be committing crimes more than 50%. We may be the 50% committer of crimes. He said, well, no, you can argue that, but that's just not a reality. It's discretionary in some cases whether you actually arrest somebody or don't. Invariably, the opinion is that black folk don't get that option, and the discretion is always to drop the hammer, so to speak, and the results are just what they are. And so we finally have an opportunity, and I hope the world of public policy discussions will now visit itself using Baltimore as the prime example. And from Baltimore will come the reality of what would have caused the situation to be so bad in Baltimore for this one human being who is no longer with us. And you begin to see the disproportionate availability of resources and conditions, and you can finally get that dialogue going. And just maybe, it may come all the way up to the point of where in this political campaign involving the presidency, the dialogue will be engaged in by the candidates on all sides of the aisle. And if that happens, maybe America will elevate its level of consciousness on the issue. I'm hopeful on the way out the door that President Obama at some point will really cause the nation to pause for one of his famous type effective publications and pronouncements. He did that on his own behalf when he tried to explain how he wasn't necessarily under the thumb of Jeremiah Wright, his pastor in Chicago, who allegations of statements that he made about America and the loyalty factor. Obama did that incredible speech, and I think it was in Pennsylvania someplace, and it really elevated the level of dialogue about racial issues. And it was from the mouth of a person who theoretically would have been assumed as exemplifying those racial issues. He could very well pick up the Baltimore situation and make it a case study for all America. And then at almost every collegiate level, the people at Stanford and other places could begin to have the same dialogue. And just maybe we could begin to change the mentality of law enforcement in this nation. I'm hopeful.
To our listeners in the radio audience, this is the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest is Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and a political commentator who's giving series of remarks on the political arena today. Let's go to another issue, that's immigration. Today, or just recently, Hillary Clinton made a fairly strong statement supporting President Obama's position on immigration. The Republican Party still seems to be going in the opposite direction. Many believe that the Latino population, because of its conservative Roman Catholic affiliations, and because of family orientation, because of work ethic, would be a natural constituency for the Republican Party. But that doesn't seem to be the case because the Republicans seem to be turning away. Is there a death wish? Why does the Republican Party not recognize this vast segment of the population for potential supporters of their party?
If I knew, I wouldn't tell them, Joe. Okay.
I know, but I'm not going to tell them either. So,
Hillary made her statement yesterday, I think, and she was looking at literally Nevada and Florida and probably two or three other states, maybe Texas, where the Latino vote equaled, on Barack Obama's behalf, the black vote the last time around. And Hillary would like to generate that same kind of reaction. Plus, I think Hillary is going to be even more aggressive than Obama was, and that is that she's going to invest a ton of resources in elevating the level of participation so that you don't get the microscopic responses vote-wise that you get in communities like Los Angeles, you know, where the numbers are under 20% of the people participating, and that's crazy. She's going to do that because she sees, in my opinion, a golden opportunity to have a Republican Party so at odds with the reality on the immigration issue that they can't get out of their way. Now, on the other hand, Bush could present a challenge to her because he is Florida-based, or he has a marital relationship or relationship that represents some Latino background, and if he plays it right, he could show up at every speech with what the grandfather used to call the little brown ones. He could show up with one of the little brown ones. And then Bush also, Jed also told me one time, we were on a program together, you know, we didn't get paid as much as Hillary and Bill, but we were compensated. And he said to me when we were joking back and forth about how inarticulate his brother really was, he said, yeah, he said, you know, the most amazing thing about my brother, though, is that he speaks better Spanish than he does English. My guess is Jed speaks a lot of Spanish, and I'm hopeful that on some of those quiet, non-interview hours, Hillary is becoming bilingual.
There have been a couple of questions, and I'll try to paraphrase them and put them together, but basically they say the same thing. Since the Supreme Court decision, which made corporations into people as far as donations and giving are concerned, is there a fear that should be around that we're moving more and more toward an oligarchy as opposed to a democracy?
Well, I think so. I think the Supreme Court has done a great disservice to the whole concept of democratic participation by allowing for the concealment of the source of money on an uncontrolled, unlimited basis. And to the extent that they have, you're moving to where people participation is being minimized, and to that extent, you're going in that direction.
Yeah. Now, that should be a concern for all of us. One last national question. At this stage in this presidency, what grade would you give President Obama?
I'm waiting for an appointment.
An appointment?
No, I'm only teasing.
The first time I ever heard his name was when you invited me to a fundraising event when he was running for the Senate of Illinois.
We did the first fundraiser ever in California for Barack Obama, and we turned out the amount of money we raised, it was big in those days. You know, we were not like the tech world, but we were pretty forceful. It was down at the Waterfront Restaurant, Al Falky's restaurant, and I still had the remnants of the mayor's power. Newsom was actually the elected mayor, but a lot of people didn't know that. I commanded people to come for this guy. And it's an interesting story because I had not met Barack Obama, and my friend Gene Duffy had called me to say, we got a brother running for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, and you've been quite recognized for giving a lot of money and raising a lot of money for the black woman who ran, Carol Moseley Braun. You did something on behalf of the guy who ran for governor in New York, and you helped Andy, you helped all these people all across the country. On the black side, you got to help this guy. And I said, well, what's his real name? he said, that is his real name. No, come on, nobody's named Barack Obama. Give me a break. He said, well, yes, it is, and I'm going to have him call you because he really should personally ask you to do it. So the call comes in, and that says, Barack Hussein Obama. State Senator from Illinois would like to talk to you. So I got on, and he said, Mayor Brown. I said, yes. He said, I understand you don't think my real name is Barack Obama. I said, well, Gene wasn't supposed to tell you that, but that is true. I did not think that. I said, I don't think anybody with that name can win. I said, well, then you're not going to help me? I said, no, I'm going to help you, but I'm just telling you, downstate Illinois is not going to vote, in my opinion, for somebody with your name. Well, Barack Obama's got to be the luckiest cat going because every opponent in Illinois always, I don't know any opponent that's totally clean in Illinois by anybody's stretch of the imaginations, and every one of them got discovered. And Obama ended up being the only one not discovered. And he ended up winning this U.S. Senate race, and then when he won the presidency, he called and said, please have Willie Brown take the telephone because this is President Barack Obama. So when I say I'm waiting for an appointment, I am as a result. But I'm telling you, we raised a lot of money for him, introduced him to a lot of people. As a matter of fact, we introduced him to Kamala Harris, and they became great friends. She helped him in his race for the nomination. She went to all those places he invited her to go to ring the doorbells, and she took a whole posse of her friends and relatives to help him out. We introduced him to a number of folk. In the black network, there's a black network around the country of people in politics who raise money to help black candidates become financially competitive, whether we're currently raising money for the mayor of Jacksonville, Florida, and hope to hell he wins, but we raised money for him. We raised money for Kasim Reed, who won re-election in Atlanta. We raised money all over this place for people on the black side, just like the tech world raises money for people interested in tech issues. Women's movement raises money for women. They've got Emily's List and two or three other organizations that do things like that. And we've got the Asians now into raising money for Asian candidates the same way. When I ran for mayor, we ran around the country, literally. We started up in Washington, in Seattle. My brother was city manager at Tacoma, and those two places kind of operate together. We started there, and we did like a 3 or 4 day swing across the nation to raise a lot of money for the race in San Francisco, and we're still doing those kinds of things. and I'm hopeful that Barack Obama would start paying back that way before he goes out the door. And his grade at the moment for me is, you know, he's got a passing grade.
Okay. I'm not going to let you off the hook completely with that. What would you consider to be his high point and his low point as President of the United States?
I think his high point has been and is health care. There is nothing that compares. There is nothing that compares to how significant that simple act really is. And just think, it took almost 70 years. In reality, Roosevelt was talking about some form of health care for people, and it never happened. Every president since then, Republican and Democrats, had talked about how to do health care. Hillary tried to step out there and do it in the early years of the Clinton administration, and she failed. Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi put it together when the Democrats had control, and they produced a quality result, and the court has virtually sustained it. And I suspect that it now has its own constituency. People who didn't have coverage now have coverage. People who couldn't afford it are now covered as if they can't afford it, which is the way health ought to be distributed. Health care really ought to be a right that you receive by virtue of your having been born and raised and in need in this country, having become a part of the body politic. Even if you are an immigrant, you ought to be entitled to that. After all, the healthier the nation, the less expensive it is to run the nation, and less expensive it is on all of us who are taxpayers. So he will be lionized long after he's gone for having done health care in a better fashion than Canadian health care or than the health care in the mother country, period. And that's his great. In his low, you ask, I would think signing on to Bush's concept of Afghanistan. I think that's a terrible tragedy. And for me, that is probably the one point that he probably regrets.
All right, thank you. We're getting low on time, but I do want to ask some questions about local politics. Ed Lee doesn't seem to have much opposition coming along for his race as mayor. Why do you think that's happening?
I said earlier that I think the nature of how we do politics in San Francisco has changed. You know, you roll backwards, and I guess for this crowd, probably it would be the time that Alioto ran, and I think there's some guy named Dobbs ran against him for mayor. Moscone ran, and he had opposition, a lot of opposition. Bava Chalada, Feinstein always had opposition. Quentin Kopp even was her opponent at one time. Agnos beat Molinari for the mayorship, and that was a heated contest. And then Jordan beat Agnos. There was always a tough race there. And then I beat Jordan. And then a guy named Amiano on a write-in tried to beat me, but he didn't succeed. Every time, in Matt Gonzalez almost beat Newsom, certainly on election day. It's been every time there's been an opponent. I don't know what Ed Lee has done where the Lord would give him a pass, like he's giving him a pass, and punish all the rest of us. I am just flabbergasted. But maybe it's how he has operated. He is not controversial at all. He's not quotable. He's just not. He could walk in now, and we wouldn't know he was here. So there may be something to that. Maybe I should have changed my.
He's in the fifth row in the back, by the way, in the center. One serious question. Because we're running out of time. And this is a combination of several from the audience. Artist studios and creative spaces are being forced to leave the city because of rent raises changing the soul of the city. David Campos is introducing legislation to put a moratorium regarding housing south of Market. What can be done and what should be done, if anything, to stop what's happening in the sense of the cost of living in this city, which has been high enough, becoming even higher and forcing so many people out?
I think the cost of living in this city is frankly a fact of life. That's what you get in a capitalistic system. Eventually, if you don't have a surplus of whatever, people tend to charge more for the few of us who are arguing to get whatever is available. That's product, that's housing, that's everything you can think of, and that is not going to alter itself in this city, nor probably any other American city, because as I said it in my formal remarks, I think we're moving to where people want to live together. People want to live in a densely populated operation. And if you are an elected official, you a public policymaker, you better understand that, because that's the way the world is going. People don't want to live way out anymore. They don't want to have to travel a long distance. Matter of fact, these 20-something don't even want to drive cars anymore. They're literally riding bicycles or walking or skateboarding. I saw some graybeard skateboarding the other day on the sidewalk in San Francisco. And so you've got the density issue. We do not deal well at all with the density issue. Our land use policies almost ignore the density issue. Campos is doing exactly that, ignoring the need for an expanded opportunity to put twice as much living space on every inch of property that exists in this city, rather than trying to close the door and not let anyone else in. I got a call a couple of days ago from Larry Baer, and he wanted, try to get me to put it in a column, I think, but he wanted me to know that they're doing 33.5% of affordable housing in the new development in Pier 70. Well, it seems to me that if were I mayor and I wanted to answer the question as I did when I was mayor, we did a $250 million affordable housing bond, and we got both the landlords and the tenants to endorse it. And we got by practically discussing how you distribute the tax payback or the tax costs for that bond. And then we took that bond and we parlayed it into more than $500 million. And we proceeded to build lots of housing units. And we started lots of the things that are currently going on. I hope this mayor will become incredibly aggressive and shut Campos down and instead substitute for what Campos is talking about, a moratorium, overnight facilitate the movement of a decision-making process on anybody who wishes to build tomorrow. If they will do like the Giants are doing with the 33.5 or whatever that number is. Because then there's so many incredible things. The housing that we built on the affordable side, each of those units are in the hands of a nonprofit group of people who apparently don't hold meetings like this to discuss how they make their decisions, etc. And they control that housing operation. I start counting how many years they've done that. And I realized at the end of my count, we're in a situation where there's probably somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion available if you refinance the existing affordable housing units being managed by the cartel. And if we refinanced, and that's the same kind of refinancing you do with your own home, because the same people who live in there will keep on living there, and they're going to keep on paying. Well, what the hell will the cartel do with the money once the mortgage is paid off And if we're in the 18th to 20th year, we're getting to the point where the mortgage will be paid off. What happens to all that money? Nobody has bothered to raise a question about that. So I'm raising the question. We ought to go refinance all of those units and pull out, because you can now get a mortgage at about 2.3 or 4%. We ought to refinance all of those units and let the tenants who are there keep paying the rent that they pay or whatever, the leasehold payments that they pay. And then we ought to take all that money and immediately, aggressively go build. And we ought to literally convince these developers who are statutorily denied the opportunity to build affordable housing. Do you know in this town there are people who have blocked the opportunity, except in the situation where it's part of mitigation and a project application, they've blocked the opportunity for folk to make a profit from building nonprofit housing. Well, we ought to let them build nonprofit housing if they will build the housing and the cost of that housing will be the same as that which is built by the nonprofit cartel. I'm telling you, I've got so many ideas connected with that. And then there's also another thing that we have in this town that you don't know about. It's yours. All those goddamn garages that people park in downtown San Francisco, you own them. You know, we have never bothered to take a look at how we could refinance those or finance them and take that money out and proceed to do something about the housing issue that doesn't go back to the voters and let the housing issue pay for itself through the so-called revenue bond process. It could be so excited to do things of that nature, and overnight you would start building huge numbers of houses, provided you could find the land. And the land is a problem. It is a major problem, which means you're going to have to team up with somebody that already has the land. You got a parking lot, you and I are going to partner up. I'm going to take your parking lot, and I'm going to build 150 units on top of your parking lot. You get the lot back, and you will control the parking that goes under there. You can charge for the parking on a limited basis. But above that, once we start making profit out of the 150 units, you're going to share in that profit. Those are the kind of creative things that we could be aggressively doing. And I'm just sorry that I'm not there, because I would be driving the same way I drove the Mission Bay development. I would be driving us and doing those kinds of things, and you would begin to address the issue. And then finally, I think on the rent control concept, I'd go to every one of the places that are rent control, and I'd say, listen, you no longer in rent control if you sell to the people who live there, but you sell on a controlled basis as what kind of profit you can make for selling. I bet you these landlords who are being harassed every day by tenants for whatever reason would sell in the minute. That means that dumbass condominium, no condominium conversion would go right out the window, and you suddenly have home ownership for people who are in San Francisco in a more dramatic way. So you want to talk about how do you make it affordable? You've got to think tomorrow. You cannot be burdened with how we did it yesterday.
You know, your passion and love for this city is so outstanding. I wish I had started that question to be the first one, because we could have continued it on. And many of us do wish you were still there, by the way.
What? Thank you.
We have time for one last question. Actually, I'm going to make a comment and ask you to respond. About a month ago or so, you suggested the possibility of Gavin Newsom as a possible vice presidential candidate. I'm getting a little worried. Are you going to suggest next that his first wife, who's a commentator on Fox, who thinks she's a political and foreign policy expert, also be considered in the running? I mean, what were you thinking when you said that?
I didn't hear you.
That brings our program to a close. Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former San Francisco mayor and noted political commentator. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the internet. I'm Joseph Fink, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.